Where is the stuff? Joseph asked softly. In fact, what stuff?
Don't, Michelle said. Please.
Who?
What?
Who? Who am I? Her expression crinkled up into misery.
What are you doing?
What's my name, Michelle?
Just stop this. It's not nice.
Uh-huh. You know, for someone who's only been away for an afternoon, I'm very hungry.
He bent down and picked up an old pizza delivery box. There was still a sliver left inside. He put it in his mouth and started to chew.
Simon's magnetic sense caught the emotional content washing through the prisoner's brain. It was changing rapidly, confusion giving way to a tide of bitter resentment.
He knows, Simon declared ruefully. Well, the scenario had almost played out. We have enough to investigate his background.
But we still don't know what they wanted to hijack a Xi'an T for.
One step at a time.
Simon's smile faded as another change swept through the prisoner. He hadn't seen the emotion too often before, and never this profound.
No taste, Joseph said. None at all. Why is that, Michelle?
Please, you're scaring me.
Fatalism, Simon said, startled by the intensity. The prisoner's bright, glowing aura began to swirl. I didn't know software could be scared.
Out, Simon bellowed.
He charged at the door. Behind him, the aura was in a frenzy of turbulence. Then it shrank to nothing.
Simon reached the door, opened it.
The prisoner exploded.
Lawrence found the darkness reassuring. He was warm. His body was perfectly comfortable and at ease. There was no pain.
It was a womb darkness, he thought, secure and nurturing. A heartbeat, he assumed, was his own, drummed out a steady rhythm in his ears. Breath flowed easily into his lungs. He supposed he could move his limbs if he wanted to. He didn't. The coziness of allowing himself to drift was too appealing. Only his eyes were ineffectual in this pleasant environment, showing him nothing. Without sight, he began to see. Events from his life slipped in and out of his consciousness, without order, as all memories were. He visited his parents, played with his brothers and sisters again. Rosalind emerged into his life, all smiles and adoration. He walked on alien worlds and kept on walking, over the plateau and into the white, cold isolation of the snowstorm. The crater lake lay below him. He spread his arms wide and dived cleanly into its deep, cleansing waters. There was the feeling of a smile, a slight mockery. His recollections weren't the only ones he was aware of, and others' distant dreams shared this universe.
Hello?
Hello, Lawrence.
Who are you?
The humans of Arnoon call me the Dragon.
Is that where we are, Arnoon?
Yes.
What's happening?
I am repairing your body.
Are you a doctor?
No.
What then?
You wish to know me?
Come.
The dragon's dreams grew stronger, and the universe was no longer a place of darkness.
It was 3:30 in the morning, Durrell time, when Simon's space plane touched down. They taxied over to the parking apron, and a set of air stairs were wheeled out. When the outer lock opened, he took a moment to breathe in the air. It was a lot better than the recycled molecules of the Norvell, but other than that, there was no distinguishing scent, nothing to mark it down as alien. Every time he stepped out on a new world, he expected to find something special, divergent. Every time, he was disappointed. Braddock Rains was waiting at the bottom of the stairs, his face grim.
Welcome to Thallspring, sir.
The 5 strong escort of Skins closed in to form a protective cordon as they walked over to the limousine.
Thank you.
Simon paused to look at the fire engines parked around the administration block. Dozens of scarlet and amber strobes were flashing across the field, acting like an advertisement for the disaster. Despite the time, a large number of spectators were still clustered behind the temporary barriers. Floodlights had been set up around the administration block, illuminating a large section of the top 2 floors, which had been blown out.
The three floors underneath it had sagged, smashing most of the surrounding glass wall. Dunes of glass fragments were strewn over the ground below. Paramedics, engineers, firemen, skins, and robots were picking their way through the wreckage, searching for survivors and bodies. Long crane gantries from the fire engines stood sentry duty, spraying water over the already soaking debris.
"Quite a mess," Simon murmured.
"Yes, sir," Braddock agreed. "The data pool is saturated with it. President Edgar Strauss is requesting an urgent clarification of the incident from General Colby. He wants to know who was to blame."
"Ah, the good president. I only dealt with him once myself. How is he?"
An awkward smile flickered over Braddock's face. Even though he had a top-level ZB security clearance, he was always edgy when reminded how many Simon Rodericks there were.
"Worried that we'll use collateral."
"Understandable. Given the circumstances, I can hardly hold Fall Springs citizens to blame. But there's no need for Strauss to know that. Have the general tell him the investigation into the cause is continuing. That should keep people on their toes." The spaceport hospital was tucked away in a small wing of the terminal building. Braddock had thrown a tight security cordon around the whole area when the badly injured Simon Rodericks was rushed in. Only ZB's own medical staff was allowed into the surgical theater to operate on him. Subsequently, it had become an intensive care unit. Security engineers and programmers had to examine and clear every piece of equipment brought in to treat him. The theater's electronics and nodes had been physically cut from the spaceport network, which itself was isolated from the data pool. Software subversion against any of the equipment was now impossible.
"Very thorough," Simon said approvingly as they walked through the hospital. "What about Adul?"
"Dead, sir," Braddock said.
"Damn, he was a good man."
Three skins were standing guard in the corridor outside the theater. One of them held the door open for Simon. A viral technician and a doctor were in the theater, monitoring the life support equipment that encrusted the figure on the bed.
"I'd like a moment alone," Simon told them. Roderick beckoned before the doctor could protest.
The startled viral technician gave Simon a long, scrutinizing glance as he walked past. Simon went over to the bed. Two of the 10 lights in the big mobile array overhead were shining across the machinery. The SK-2 had 73% burns, which had been sealed under a thick oyster membrane that had its own plexus of fluid capillaries to treat the ruined tissue. His head had been completely covered, leaving just two small slits, one for his mouth and one for the eye, that had been saved. An oxygen tube passed straight through the membrane to the remnants of his nose. His left hand had been amputated, as had both legs below the knees.
"Can you hear me?" Simon asked.
The SK-2's eye opened. Air hissed out past his teeth.
"That alien motherfucker.
If it's any comfort, he's in a worse state than you. They're still scraping bits of him off the ceiling."
"What ceiling? There isn't even a building left. Hell, I was stupid. I should have realized what it was capable of."
"Yes, well, as a suicide method, it certainly beats a toothful of cyanide. I didn't realize the human body contained quite so much chemical energy."
"Not human. Alien."
"No. I've reviewed the data on my way down. Our own dear experts have made some headway. His DNA is confirmed as human. It wasn't even modified. The microparticles were foreign to his body. Not that we have many of them to study from those samples you took, a few hundred thousand, but it would seem they rebuild the molecular structure of the cell that they occupy. The modifications are not genetically sequenced. You know what that means."
"Alien."
"The technology certainly is. We've ruled out a Santa Chico connection. This is way beyond anything they have. It's a working nanonic system that can engineer molecular biology." The SK-2's breath hissed loudly again.
"Find it,"
he groaned. Several monitor lights turned red.
"God, fuck, it hurts."
"They're just stabilizing you. It'll take another 2 days before you're ready for regeneration viral therapy."
"Are my balls still there?"
"Apparently so, yes."
"Thank fuck for that."
They told me about the rest.
I know. Both goddamn legs.
They'll be replaced as soon as we get home, along with everything else.
Who fucking Ra?
Would you like me to have you placed in hibernation sleep?
No, I'm going to see this through.
As you wish.
Of course I fucking wish. You know what this means, don't you?
The potential for a working nanonic is quite phenomenal, yes.
Phenomenal, my ass, the SK-2 rasped. It's total. We can elevate the whole human race, and in real time, too.
No more waiting for backward regions to benefit from our investment. No more germline V-writing health policy.
My God, we've won.
Everything we wanted to achieve can be implemented. There'll be no more moron barbarians holding us back. Society can shift to an entirely active, creative economy.
Let's hope so, Simon said cautiously.
Hope be damned.
Simon didn't enjoy seeing his clone sibling in so much pain. It was far too easy to visualize himself lying on the theater bed with little machines leeched to him. The SK-2 was fixating on the prospect of finding nanonics as a way of justifying his own suffering, making the sacrifice and pain worthwhile, which it would be, Simon conceded. But the alien was deploying its nanonics in a very strange and definitely hostile way. We're still not certain about this nanonic system's capabilities. So far, we have a lot of conjecture from overexcited technical staff. Nothing concrete.
I saw him, what he became. We can rebuild every human in the universe to make them sane and intelligent.
As sane and intelligent as we are, Simon thought he kept the tone irony-free.
That's what we exist for.
Quite, although we never envisaged achieving it in one big bang. Simon almost asked, what if people don't want to be altered by us?
But he already knew the SK-2's answer to that. The discovery of this nanonic technology would cause an unprecedented split in the board. Some batches would demand immediate implementation, while others, like his own, would want to move more cautiously.
Although that would be completely hypothetical unless he did actually find the alien and obtain the entire technology. Simon gave the SK-2 a thoughtful look. Was that why he'd refused hibernation, to make sure the acquisition was completed? The very fact that he could think that of a clone sibling made him uneasy.
Well, now we can modify our original objective to take that into account, can't we? The SK-2 said.
That's some modification you're asking for. But possible, and extremely desirable.
Absolutely. Interrogate the girl first, Michelle Rake. She's a very weak link in their security.
Of course. Any thoughts on why the alien is using its technology against us?
No. We don't have enough information yet. You will have to determine that as well.
The dragon's dreams were everything Lawrence had ever dreamed of. He embraced the irony with a kind of bitter humor as he learned of the Ring Empire. Once again, the universe had shifted around him, taking away the life he thought was real. Colorful, elegant facts slowly coalesced, merging with his own thoughts until they became revelation. Within this strange state of enlightenment, he floated serenely after Mozart as the prince flitted from planet to planet. There were, Lawrence realized, huge segments missing from the story.
Most of my memories are lost, the dragon said regretfully.
This is real, then? Lawrence asked as he gazed across the city, marveling at the silver and crystal palaces emerging in the rosy dawn light.
This is history.
How long ago?
Tens of millions of years, if not longer.
Again, that information no longer exists within me.
If his eyes had been open, Lawrence was sure he would have wept. The dragon's knowledge was stupendous, its physical science tremendous. The potential was here to achieve anything.
Lawrence wasn't just awed, he was humbled. His own goals seemed utterly inconsequential and petty compared to all this. Yet the dragon didn't judge him, which made his guilt all the greater.
I hoped I would find wealth here, Lawrence said, but I never expected to be this rich.
The villagers never considered themselves rich.
They are, believe me. There could be no greater gift than knowing you.
You are the kind of hope I had long since stopped believing in.
Thank you, though it is humans who must take the credit for resurrecting me this far. I would not exist if it were not for your endeavors.
I would know one thing, Lawrence said, even though he felt ashamed at asking. Are you sure about Mozart? Did those places and species he encountered on his voyage genuinely exist?
The memories are all I have. They are what I am.
Does your past exist, Lawrence?
There are times when I wish it didn't.
Denise had risen soon after dawn, content to be in her own bed for what she sincerely hoped was going to be the last time. With the light growing outside, she went onto the balcony of her parents' A-frame home. For once, the sun was visible as a splendid copper crescent rising in the cleft between Mount Arnau and Mount Nolan. Denise took that as a good omen. It was rare for the cleft to be free of fog and cloud so early in the morning. Now she could lean on the carved wooden rail to look out across the marvelous crumpled valleys and craggy rock faces that composed Arnoon. A shallow layer of mist hung over the meandering slopes spread out around her, with only the tallest treetops poking out above its frayed surface. The sun's radiance fluoresced in a delicate rose gold as it gently slid and slithered its way out of the foothills toward the plain below. After a light breakfast with her parents, she walked across the village to the big snowbark pavilion. The air up on the plateau was a lot cooler than the humid coastal climate that she'd grown accustomed to down at Mimu Bay. She put on a willow wool sweater before leaving the house, a present from Jacintha, whose husband Lycor had designed it, as always incorporating bright colors without making them garish. This one was midnight black with curling flecks of sapphire, topaz, and magenta, looking as if they were being blown across the weave. Its sleeves were flared at the wrists, with a small V-gap allowing her to roll them up. It kept her beautifully warm as the cold morning gusts drifted down from Mount Kenzie. As she walked, friends she hadn't seen in an age came over to greet her and exchange pleasantries and words of encouragement. They all expressed their sorrow over Joseph, as if she somehow suffered his loss more than they. It was wrong, she felt. They were treating her as if she'd achieved something instead of nearly bringing ruination to them all. But to say so to their faces would be selfish, and there was still hope, not that she could ever have imagined it would present itself in such a strange form. Before the children arrived, she walked around the inside of the pavilion, trailing her hand over the bark of each of the 10 trees, reacquainting herself with them. So many hours of a pleasant childhood had been spent in or around the pavilion with her friends, playing games and listening to the adults tell their fantastical stories. It was fitting that she, the one who'd been chosen to seed their way of life on a new world, should be given a last opportunity to tell the new generation of their heritage. The children began to arrive, little groups of them, bounding over the central meadow, chattering and laughing. Denise smiled in reflex. Something about happy children was just infectious. Their smiles made the world a less painful place. Parents were bringing smaller children. She saw Jacintha and Lycor with little Elizabeth holding their hands as she toddled along between them. Eventually, after some coaxing, the children were settled in a big semicircle around Denise. "Have you all heard the stories of Mozart and Indolian?" she asked them. "Yes," they cried back. "Well, today I'm going to tell you the last story of the Ring Empire. This is set long after the time of Mozart and Indolian. It's sort of a sad time, because the Ring Empire was starting to decay. Some of the inhabitants blamed the machines for this, because they were now so smart that they took care of people from the moment they were born until they died. This machine-pampered generation had nothing to do except live their lives chasing personal pleasure and satisfaction. They became decadent and not a little bit cruel. Now this generation, the final generation, had enormous resources at their disposal. Their machines could dismantle the very planets and reshape their atoms to build whatever these people wanted. With that kind of ability, you'd think they'd be totally content. But no. Even the number of planets is finite. They began to argue with each other about how many resources any one person should have,
and how these resources should be divided and supervised. At first, it was just arguments. Then it grew into theft and hoarding. Eventually, fighting began and grew into what was known as the Decadence War. The individual kingdoms that had been so closely knit turned against each other. Battle machines were constructed, the most terrifying things ever built, equipped with weapons that could tear a planet to pieces and even extinguish stars. These battle machines fought each other over the division of entire solar systems, and it took an enormous amount of resources just to build them. That meant that any solar systems that the battle machines conquered were soon turned into more battle machines. The last generation was deprived of the one thing they had launched the war for. Without the resources they craved, they soon dwindled into extinction amid the conflict. The battle machines continued fighting for thousands of years, wreaking havoc among the stars, until they had finished eliminating each other, along with entire races. But the Decadents and their battle machines weren't the only reason the Ring Empire fell, although they must take most of the blame. They represented only the physical aspect of its decline. Many societies had followed the Wilfrine, slowly regressing, even rejecting their technological society, seeking a more primitive existence in search of peace, withdrawing their participation and support from the Ring Empire. Then there were others, like the Outbounds and the Last Church, who had actually been quite successful in reaching their goals. They had attracted the most dynamic people, the brightest, the restless, who relished challenge. All of these had found their cause and given themselves to it. In doing so, over the millennia, they had drained the Ring Empire of vitality, the very people who could have regenerated it. Among the factions and wars was one group who had predicted the fall. The Eternals, who were more academics than anything else, had studied civilizations from across the Ring Empire. They found one thing that remained constant among all biological species: the cycles of growth and decay. It might take only a century, it might take a million years, but life always follows that pattern. As the Decadence War raged and the Ring Empire fell apart around them, they decided to save themselves. Many groups were desperately trying to do the same thing, with colonies and secret enclaves to keep their original ideals alive, so that one day they could expand again, rekindling their former glory. In some instances, entire kingdoms isolated themselves behind fortified borders so that they wouldn't be contaminated with the decay infecting their neighbors. All of them were attempting to resist that which the Eternals were convinced was inevitable. By doing so, they would surely be doomed to failure, the Eternals thought. And they were right, for today there is no Ring Empire, only whispers and legends of the glory that was. But the Eternals are still here. Instead of making some futile stand against the decline, the Eternals embraced the cycle of life. They transformed themselves and their society so that it would live in harmony with galactic nature. Biological life and Ring Empire machine were fused at a molecular level. The Eternals became giant spaceborne creatures. Unlike starships, they didn't need artificial power and great industrial stations to maintain them. In many respects, these creatures were profoundly simple. It is that simplicity that has allowed them to survive and spread across the galaxy. They live today in orbit above the galaxy's red giant stars, powered by the heat and grazing on the solar wind. They have enormous solid bodies like streamlined asteroids that sprout solar wings, whose span is measured in kilometers. Because of their shape and the fiery environment in which they thrive, we call them dragons. They are even hatched from eggs. Every solar system has them. Dark, cold globes circling among the outer cometary halo as they wait for the star's main sequence to come to an end. That's the cycle again. Stars grow old and die, swelling out to absorb their planets and eventually expanding into red giants. That's when their warmth reaches the eggs, energizing them. They grow slowly, absorbing the heat and the thin gusts of ions until they're full-fledged dragons. And then they listen to the universe. Their wings are threaded with elements that can pick up radio waves from the other side of the galaxy, and even far beyond that, allowing them to listen to planetary civilizations as they rise and fall.
They listened to the cosmos itself, the death and birth of stars, the shriek of matter as it falls into black holes, quasars and pulsars crying out from the empty void. All this knowledge they spread among themselves and think about it and remember it. On rare occasions they even use it, for they can modify themselves at a molecular level. That is their physical nature, the legacy of the Ring Empire. Eventually, as the star shrinks back to a white dwarf before its final distinction, they are left abandoned in the dark and cease to be. And accepting their mortality, they live with the cycle, with what's natural. They have served their purpose and advanced their species. Like any civilization, they acquire knowledge. They organize it and bestow it on their descendants. As they circle above their stupendous star, they send their own eggs out into the universe, each one containing the memory of everything they consider important and relevant. These eggs fall through the darkness of interstellar space until the gravity of some bright new star pulls them into a long-distant orbit so the cycle can be started over. Except one of them fell to Earth, or rather, Thallspring, Lawrence said. The children gasped and turned. Lawrence was leaning casually against the trunk of a snowbark, arms folded across his chest. His grin was lopsided as he stared at Denise. The children whispered excitedly. "That was over 2,000 years ago," Lawrence continued. He grinned down at the expectant, slightly awed faces. "The dragon's egg streaked out of the sky like a splinter of sunlight and struck the plateau near the base of Mount Kenzie. The force of the blow was so powerful it gouged a crater out of the bare rock. Every tree for 50 kilometers was ripped out of the ground and smashed apart by the blast wave. Then the timber burned for days, filling the air with thick black smoke. But the dust from the vaporized rock billowed up into the stratosphere and blotted out the sun for weeks. It brought the coldest winter the plateau has ever known, covering it in snow. Then when the snow began to melt a few years later, it filled the crater with water. The trees started to grow again. And 100 years later, everything looked just the same, except now there was a new lake. Then people arrived and called this place Arnoon. They built themselves a village and began harvesting the willow webs. And one day, Denise said, my grandfather was out prospecting when his survey sensors found a strange magnetic pattern in the rock under the lake. So he started to dig. It took months for his little robot to excavate a shaft down to the base of the island. But when it got there, my grandfather found fragments of the egg. He didn't know what they were, only that they were artificial solid-state matrices of some kind, unlike anything humans had ever built. He began to excavate further and eventually found the largest fragment of all, the one we call the dragon. By then, Lawrence said, he'd discovered that the molecular structure of the small fragments was storing data. After a lot of experiments, he finally managed to access some of it. Once he knew how to do that, he started to mine the huge reservoir of information stored within the dragon. The dragon was still sleeping, Denise said. It possessed nothing but disconnected memories. My grandfather wrote programs that linked them together. The dragon slowly began to wake. It learned how to think. He looked straight at her, heedless of their audience. And you found that it was actually a cohesive nanonic system capable of molecular engineering. You used it to adapt native plants to grow terrestrial food. You used it to make yourselves resistant to disease. You made it synthesize bits of technology that are orders of magnitude more advanced than anything humans can make. And you kept it all for yourselves. Because it can only change itself into what we ask for. It can't build anything new. It doesn't know how. That data was lost in the destruction of the impact. Every pattern form sequencer particle in my body was a part of the dragon. It diminished itself to enhance me. It diminished itself further to heal you. Yeah, Lawrence said. His belligerence faded. Makes righteous life kind of awkward, doesn't it? Denise turned back to the children. So now you know why things are a little different here than on the rest of Thallspring. A very noble creature has sacrificed part of itself to make our lives easier. Our debt to the dragon is enormous. We must never forget what we owe, and we must pray that one day we can repay it. The children filtered out past the snow-barked trunks. Many of them crept up close to Lawrence, then dashed away, giggling. Approaching the big, bad skin man was a seriously scary dare. He found it rather funny. Jacinta came up to him, little Elizabeth, cradled on her arm. The girl was shy, burying her face in her mother's neck. "I do remember you now," Lawrence said. She nodded a fraction reluctantly. "I'm sorry we became enemies again." "Love and war. I guess that's part of the human cycle."
"We hope to break that, with the dragon's help."
"I know. It told me." Jacinta glanced over at her sister, who was waiting for them, a disapproving expression on her elegant young face.
"Try not to give her too hard a time. She has to do this."
"Don't worry. I know what I have to do as well." Jacinta gave him a mildly suspicious look, then walked away back to Lycor. Elizabeth gave him a little wave from the crook of her mother's arm. He shook his own fingers at the young girl, smiling.
"We have Grabowski," Denise said briskly. "I'm willing to offer you a deal.
You can't go back to Xandiu Braun,
so if you cooperate with us, the pattern-form sequencer particles will repair all Grabowski's damage, including his brain, and he can begin a new life here in the village."
Lawrence widened his smile until it became suitably irritating. "I don't need a deal. I'm going to help you anyway."
"What do you mean?" she asked slowly.
"You want to take the dragon fragment to Aldebaran, right? The closest red giant where all the real dragons are."
"Yes." She said it as if admitting a fatal weakness. "They can make it whole again. If it stays here, then your kind will discover it one day. They'll take it from us and break it apart in their corporate labs to discover how pattern-form sequencing systems work. I can't let that happen. It's a living entity that has given us so much, and we've never done anything for it. This is our only chance to return it where it belongs."
"My kind, huh?"
"Xandiu Braun, or Thallspring's government. People who don't live out here like this. People who don't live real lives, who'll never care about anything but themselves."
"You know, there's more of your kind than you think. Everywhere I go, I keep bumping into idealists."
"A shame. None of it rubs off on you."
"I'm helping you, aren't I?"
"Why? Why would you agree to help?"
"Raw altruism not good enough for you?"
He wasn't about to tell her the shock he'd experienced on hearing about the Mordif, nor its accompanying revelation. "I don't believe it. Not from you. You came here to steal the dragon. You wouldn't switch sides and morality this quickly."
"I didn't know the dragon existed before I arrived. I thought you'd got a big stash of gold or diamonds hidden away up here."
"But..." She gave him a troubled look. "Where did you get your prime from?"
"A boy I knew once back on Amethai. A good kid. A little bit misguided and confused, but then isn't everyone at that age?"
"So Earth has found a dragon."
"No. That's why I'll help you." Michelle didn't know where she was, nor what time it was. She wasn't entirely sure what day it was. After the skins had dragged her from her room, she'd been driven somewhere in a blacked-out van. The medical orderlies from the elevator went with her. They tore her T-shirt off so their probes could inspect and scratch her skin. Needles were inserted into her flesh along her limbs and belly, leaving small beads of blood welling up when they were extracted. She'd screamed and pleaded and struggled. It was all futile. A skin pinned her down until their examination ended. Her ruined T-shirt was thrown back at her, and she tried to wrap it round her breasts. Now that they'd finished, the men showed no more interest in her as she lay on the floor of the van, weeping pitifully. She half expected them to rape her, but that didn't happen either. The trip lasted 15 minutes. When she was hustled out of the van, it had been parked in some anonymous underground garage. She was marched directly to a small cell and pushed inside. The door slammed shut. After the first hour, she thought they'd forgotten about her. She banged on the door. But nobody came. She started weeping again, hating herself for being so weak. She was just so frightened. Xandiu Braun could do whatever they wanted to her, anything. Nobody would know. If she could just see Joseph,
This horror could be endured if he was with her. Slowly, she shrank into a fetal position on the cot, hugging her legs tight to her chest. Little bursts of sobbing came and went. Why didn't they just take her out and start their interrogation? Just get this over with. At some time, she must have drifted into sleep. The door, thudding open, woke her with a start. A skin walked in. Michelle clutched the ragged T-shirt to her chest, staring fearfully at the dark, bulky figure. Suddenly, she wasn't so keen for the interrogation to start after all. "You, with me, now," the skin beckoned. Michelle was led along cheerless basement corridors to an elevator. It brought her up to the main levels of the building. She thought it looked like an extremely high-class hotel with luxurious gold carpeting and gloss-polished wood doors. Large, elaborate oil paintings hung on the walls. Delicate antique tables supported china vases full of big flower arrangements. Lighting cones were gilded in silver and cut crystal. It wasn't a hotel. Open doors gave her glimpses into offices. The men inside and hurrying along the corridor all shared a tense, preoccupied air. Few of them even spared her a second look. The scan finally opened the door into an office with a single desk. A man was waiting for them, dressed in a smart gray and purple suit, styled differently from anything she'd seen on Thallspring. "I'll take her from here," he told the scan. Michelle barely heard. She was looking out of the window. The view showed her a swath of formal grounds, sweeping away to a broad circular highway. Beyond that were the familiar, sturdy public buildings that populated the center of Durrell. But to be seeing them from this angle, she'd have to be inside the Eagle Manor. "I'm Braddock Rains," the man was saying. "Please." He took his jacket off and proffered it to her. "Sorry about the way you've been treated. The frontline boys tend to become slightly over-enthusiastic, especially on an operation with such a high priority." "Operation?" she asked blankly. She was still having trouble with what was happening. "All in good time." He smiled reassuringly and gestured at a tall double door. "My chief would like a word." There was a larger office through the doors. The man sitting behind its broad desk gave Michelle a pleasant nod as she was shown in, then returned his attention to a pane in front of him. It was difficult to tell how old he was. Mid-40s, she thought, though he had the kind of assured authority that was normally found in men a lot older. Braddock steered her to a settee and indicated she should sit. She pulled the jacket around her as if it were a shield. "My name is Simon Roderick," said the man behind the desk. "I'm in charge of Xantiu Braun's security on Thallspring. And you, Michelle, have been a very stupid young lady." She dropped her gaze, praying she wouldn't start sniveling. "One thing in your favor right now is that we know you're actually human."
"Excuse me?" she stammered.
"You're a human, unlike this gentleman." The sheet screen on the wall flashed up a picture of Joseph's face. "Ah, you do recognize him?"
"Yes."
"Thank you, Michelle. At least you have some understanding of how much trouble you're in."
"One day you'll be defeated," she said, amazing herself at such defiance.
"It's not only Xantiu Braun that will be defeated by aliens that powerful. The entire human race could well be facing a terminal threat."
"What do you mean, aliens?"
"You didn't know, did you? Your comrade in arms was not entirely human."
"That's ridiculous."
"Nobody was more human than Joseph. Only a human could bring another human so much pleasure and contentment."
"Is it?"
Joseph's image was replaced by a cluster of multicolored spheres. "Do you know what that is, Michelle?"
"No."
"That doesn't surprise me. We're not absolutely sure ourselves. It's a nanomachine that appears to have molecular engineering capabilities. It was extracted from your friend's blood."
"What have you done to Joseph?"
Tears threatened to burst down her face, but it was anger that pushed them this time, not fear. "Joseph?" Simon smiled. "Finally, a name." Michelle's shoulders slumped. The anger burned out as quickly as it had flared. How stupid to be caught out like that.
"You can do what you like to me," she said sullenly. "I won't help you."
Simon walked around the desk and sat on the settee next to Michelle. She tried not to shrink from him. He poured some tea from the silver pot on the low table.
"Do you know what we can do to you?" he asked. "Did Joseph ever tell you?"
"You'll use drugs, I know that. And you'll probably rape me before you kill me."
"Good grief, what a repellent idea. We're not savages. My dear girl, you really must learn to distinguish between facts and your own side's somewhat lurid propaganda. Yes, we can use drugs, along with various hypnosis and deep stimulus techniques, none of which are particularly pleasant. There is nothing you will be able to keep from us. You will confess your deepest secrets. Do you know why we're not doing that to you right now?"
"So you can trick me into giving you names," she said hotly.
"No. I want to appeal to you to give us the information voluntarily. Time, I'm afraid, is rather short. I really am not joking when I say Joseph is an alien."
"What have you done with him?"
"Nothing. I wish we could. He escaped shortly after we captured him."
"Good. You'll never catch him again."
"Not without your help, no."
"I won't. You'll have to interrogate me properly."
She was shaking at the prospect of submitting to their interrogation, but every minute in here was another minute Joseph could use to flee. "Aren't you going to ask where we caught him? Or do you already know? Did you help plan the attack?"
"I don't know what you're talking about," she said,
though there was a horrible suspicion bubbling through her mind. Those nights he never came home. Courier duty, he said, like the rest of the cell were given. Except she'd never been asked to run anything at night. Simon picked up his cup of tea and settled back into the settee. The sheet screen began showing a data pool news report of the spaceport. Body bags were being carried out of the wrecked administration block.
"Oh, God," she whispered.
8 people dead, Simon said, including Mr. Raines's colleague. Braddock Raines was standing at the end of the settee, his face impassive. Michelle flashed him a hugely guilty glance. 17 injured, 3 critically. Our cargo lifting operation delayed by several days. And the whole of Durell terrified about what retaliatory measures ZB will employ. After all, we promised to use our collateral necklaces to prevent any interruption to our asset realization. What do you think, Michelle? How many Thal Spring citizens should ZB kill so that your resistance movement doesn't do this again? 10?
Stop it.
50?
None, she shouted. None at all. He didn't do this. We didn't do this. All we do is sabotage your transport and stolen factories. This isn't what we want, not killing people.
That's not what you want, Michelle. There's a difference in your understandable, if pathetic, yearning to fight the invasion and the goals of your alien allies.
Joseph is not an alien.
Dear me, what an irony I have here. We can extract the entire truth from you, should we so wish, yet we cannot install the truth. But the truth is what I am dealing in. Joseph's body was altered, enhanced by alien technology. He was using you.
He was not. We were in love.
Ah, Simon sighed happily. Was this your first love, Michelle? So it was. How delightful.
No, it wasn't.
Even as she denied it, she knew Roderick knew, really knew, and blushed heavily. There is a standard ploy that intelligence agencies use for infiltrating their enemies, Michelle. It's very common, and has been in use for centuries. You find some lonely, sad little soul working in the place you need to be. A woman maybe approaching middle age and unmarried, or maybe not as pretty as her contemporaries. Perhaps it's simply someone who doesn't fit into her new environment very easily, who finds it all new and strange and frightening. Either way, you send in a wolf. They meet as if by chance. She finds herself courted by this most handsome man, impossibly talented in bed, devoted to her and her alone. Her heart belongs to him. And with her heart comes her complete and absolute trust. Does any of this sound familiar, Michelle?
Don't, she said weakly.
Did he come into your life around the time we arrived on your planet, Michelle? This is your first year at university, the first time you've ever really been away from home. Your grades weren't very good. You were lonely. Did you meet him on campus?
No.
Before then?
Of course.
The real first time you left home. Your mother and father paid for a vacation at Mimu Bay, a reward for passing your exams.
That's it, isn't it? That's where you met him. It was a classic, perfect holiday romance.
Michelle was sobbing helplessly. The pain the words inflicted was worse than any torture.
He loves me. He does.
Then we invaded. He appeared back into your life as if by magic.
Yes, he lived with you unofficially, of course. There's no record of him in the university files.
In fact, there's no record of him anywhere on Thallspring. Digitally, he simply doesn't exist.
Do you know how impossible that is, Michelle? The most powerful Askbings ever written cannot find a single trace of him in the global data pool.
He's human, Michelle implored. Please.
She turned to Raines, who shook his head sorrowfully. Did Joseph tell you if he had special software? Simon continued relentlessly. Really clever, super-secret software that could help the cause? Michelle was starting to curl up back into a fetal position. The brutal voice just went on and on, tearing her world apart.
Software that was better than any AS on Earth could ever produce. What did he say, that it was written by a few teenage geeks in their bedrooms who also just happened to be loyal to the Thallspring cause?
Simon put his index finger under the girl's chin and tilted her face back. Her cheeks were sticky with tears. His electromagnetic sense observed the tidal waves of distress tormenting her thoughts.
I'm so sorry, he said tenderly. I really am. This is all as frightening to me as it is to you.
Prime, Michelle stammered. The software was called Prime.
It was quite an operation, lifting the dragon out of its underground lair. The route had been prepared years ago, of course. Denise's family had sunk a second shaft down to the chamber, a bigger shaft than the elevator, which emerged to the side of the small stone temple. Lawrence sat on the curving stone bench, watching as its concealed hood rose up on magnetic pistons, bringing a meter of soil with it. The dragon slowly emerged underneath, still sitting on its white glass pedestal. Its golden power induction mesh was wrapped tightly around its midsection. Sunlight glinted off individual strands. Electrohydraulic motors whined loudly in the placid air.
Welcome to the world, Lawrence said. I don't suppose you can sense visible light.
Not directly, the dragon replied. However, I receive the images from yourself and other humans. I know what Arnoon looks like. It is very beautiful. Repairing Lawrence's leg and hip wasn't all the pattern form sequencer particles had done. They'd also modified a cluster of his neuron cells, giving them an ability similar to a DNI implant. D-writing, Denise called it. The particles engineering cellular structures in a direct fashion that human V-writing could never achieve, outside of germline treatments. Vectoring in new DNA was a scattergun approach deployed against entire organs or muscles. This was far more selective and precise.
But you haven't given this communication cluster to everyone here? He'd asked her.
The two of them had sat together in the Snowbark Pavilion for most of the morning, discussing how to get the dragon up to a starship. They were being polite to each other, nothing more. There was too much history for friendship.
No, she said. Only people like me and Raymond and Jacintha needed. We didn't want to create some kind of super warrior breed.
The enhancements given to the children are more benign and beneficial.
Similar to germline V-writing?
Yes. The pattern form sequencers can alter DNA quite easily. We gave everybody cancer resistance and stronger immune systems and refined organs, much greater life expectancy, a higher IQ. Their changes will be permanent, and the traits will carry down the generations. Arnoon won't have to depend on the dragon anymore.
And the food, he said. There was a carved wooden bowl on the table in front of him. It was piled with various fruits. He rested his finger on the rim, pressing it down so the bowl swung from side to side.
The plants are also genetic adaptations, Denise said, enjoying his discomfort. They'll breed true. In 100 years, this forest will be an orchard that can feed a city.
Nobody will need protein cell refineries anymore. Another economic necessity will be consigned to history.
An economic necessity that liberated 70% of the human race from perpetual starvation. Growing things for food is a terribly inefficient use of energy.
That depends on the nature of the culture you have to feed, she said.
Massive industrialized nations had to use industrial farming to feed their urban populations. If you replace them with scattered self-sufficient villages like Arnoon, then the requirements become very different.
A world of physically separate communities linked by the data pool, the true global village. Knowledge belongs to everybody, and everybody goes their separate ways. You need micro-scale manufacturing to back that up, you know.
I know. We've been studying the dragon as best we can, and we've copied every memory it has. If we give that to the rest of the world, then we hope something similar to the pattern form sequencer can be built. It'll take decades, but we never wanted to force change overnight. This is going to be an organic revolution, generated from internal knowledge. It must succeed. If not here, then on a fresh world. Today's culture can't be the only way a technological society develops. It can't.
His eyes flashed with mischief. Plenty of prejudices to overcome.
There certainly are. She picked a peach from the top of the bowl and held it up in front of him.
You sure? Last time a girl did this to me, I threw up all over her.
You're just a born romantic, aren't you?
He took the peach and bit into it. The fruit was sweet and succulent. Quite pleasant, really.
It's not just fruit we get from our trees, Denise said innocently. Some of them grow meat, too.
Lawrence had trouble swallowing.
He saw Hal before he left. The kid was in one of the A-frames, sleeping peacefully. His medical modules had all been repaired and were now industriously cycling chemicals through various organs once more, and his skin was a much healthier color.
The major internal damage has almost been repaired, the doctor said. We'll start removing these modules in a day or two. I'm a little concerned about his biomech heart.
What's wrong with it? Lawrence asked.
It's somewhat crude. I believe it was only intended as a temporary replacement. I'm not sure how long it will last, and with the dragon leaving, we don't have enough pattern form sequencer particles to rebuild it. He'll probably need another transplant in 20 years.
Lawrence chuckled.
I wonder what kind of heart that'll be.
Who knows?
What about his brain?
That will take more time to repair. He lost a lot of neurons from oxygen starvation. The pattern form particles are rebuilding as fast as they can, but it will be weeks before full intellectual function is returned.
A concept that applied to Hal made Lawrence grin.
Will his full memories come back?
No. Not even the dragon's systems can recover them. There will be large gaps in his life.
Lawrence stroked Hal's forehead.
I think that's probably a good thing if he's to make a fresh start here.
Yes.
Do me a favor. Take those valves out. That'll give him a real fresh start.
Of course. Is there a message when he recovers?
Just, I don't know. Good luck, I guess.
It was pretty lame, he had to admit. But really, what else was there to say?
The kid had a chance at a new life here. Why tie him to the past?
Perhaps you could record a message, the dragon suggested.
No. Cutting him loose is the best thing I can do for him. Besides, the last thing he needs is advice from me. Look what a screw-up I made of everything.
I believe that's what you call sweet fate.
Lawrence touched two fingers to his forehead, saluting the dragon as a heavy-lift robot eased it off the pedestal.
You got me there.
Jacintha came into the temple and sat beside him. A small cargo robot rolled up behind her. The island's shoreline was nearly invisible under all the boats that had brought people and equipment over from the village. Lawrence hoped Dohel ZB's spy satellites didn't notice all the unusual activity. The villagers claimed they'd tracked everything the starships had launched into low orbit around Tholspring. If they were right, they had a clear sky above them right now.
Your skin's ready, Jacintha said, indicating the fat plastic case that the robot was carrying.
Thanks. I thought that was dead.
We had an antidote to shark pike venom long before we ever found the dragon. As long as it's applied quickly, you're okay. The skin's muscle cords were receptive once we'd flushed the contaminated blood out. Thanks. Those damn things scared me shitless. Every rose has its thorns. The rivers around here are full of shark pikes. I've been bitten a couple of times myself. Can't you introduce some kind of virus? Wipe them out. Jacintha's expression darkened. Is my little sister really going to be able to trust you? Yeah, she can trust me. She's the closest thing to a genuine killboy there is. I was part of the team that wiped out your platoon. And now that's all in the past? This from a man who would genocide a species because it has sharp teeth. The platoon followed me, Lawrence said slowly. I brought them up here. You might have pulled the trigger, but it was me who put them in front of you. And there I was thinking you were going to say they knew the risks. That, too. We don't expect a population to fight back, and we certainly don't expect it in the hinterlands of Thallspring. But each time we land, we know it's a possibility. Denise might have had a few zippy gadgets, but her real advantage over us was how willing people were to sign up at her bogus resistance movement. If the local inhabitants ever get properly organized or call ZB's bluff, we automatically lose. Do you really think a starship captain, a flesh-and-blood human who has family of his own, is ever, ever going to give an order for a gamma pulse that will slaughter 500,000 people? It won't happen. So we know we're on our way down here, that there's no fallback, no help from above. The fact that Denise eliminated so many of us in Memu Bay proves what I've known for a long time now, that ZB is in decline. Probably a terminal one. Skin suits are superb technology, even up against your dragon's knowledge. But without the organization, the initiative, and the determination to face down threats, that means nothing. And we had none of those qualities down in Memu Bay. Santa Chico should have told the board that asset realization was over, finished for good. Instead, they just kept on trying to find weaker targets. You agree with the Eternals, then? Life is in a permanent cycle. Lawrence let out a long breath, exhausted with holding back his anger and despair. Could be. You know what? I really don't care. I don't care that you killed my friends. I don't care that I killed your ambush party. I don't care if that makes us quits or not. I don't care that ZB is quietly collapsing. I don't care that you want to build some noble civilization based on total bullshit about people being perpetually nice to each other. I don't care that your deranged sister is willing to sacrifice herself and everyone she knows to save some piece of talking rock. I don't damn well care that the universe is doomed and the galaxy is falling into a black hole. I have spent the last 20 years caring. I cared for my platoon. I cared about what the human race was doing and where it was going. I cared that we didn't have frontiers anymore. I cared about my career. I even cared about what I was doing with my life. And look where I am because of that. Helping a bunch of cosmic hippies hijack a starship. Sweet fucking fate. You mean we can't trust you? You got it, girl. Denise cannot trust me. Not now, not ever. I do not like her. I will never like her. I will, however, respect her abilities. And I expect a similar respect in return. What you can have from me is reliability. I am dependable in this, in a way none of you are. I will hijack that starship, and it will fly to Aldebaran. Of that you can be certain. I'm not sure I can be, Lawrence. This is for me now, not you and your ideals. That's why you can be certain. I finally have a chance to put my life back together and live it the way I was born to live it. To cancel out the last 20 miserable years. After Aldebaran, I'm going home. That's all. Home. And nothing and nobody can stop that from happening. The sound of the hovercraft approaching made both of them turn and look out across the crater lake. Lawrence couldn't help a derisory laugh at the absurdity of the vehicle. It was made from wood, Arnoon's lightest, hardest timber, crafted into a simple oval platform with a cabin grafted onto the prow.
Two big steerable propellers stood high on smooth, tall fins at the rear. The skirt was willow wool, a fine tight weave easily holding in the cushion of air on which it rode. Electric motors powered the propellers and impellers, salvaged from an assortment of heavy machinery across the plateau. It swept lightly across the water with a thin haze of spray escaping from underneath its skirt and a creamy V-shaped wake spreading wide. When it reached the island, it rocked slightly as the front skirt rode up the shingle and onto the scanty grass moss. The propellers reversed pitch, bringing it to a halt. It sank down with a prolonged wheeze of escaping air. The heavy-lift robot carrying the dragon trundled over to it. A ramp was deployed in front of the propeller fins, enabling it to climb up onto the deck. "We're ready," Denise said. She gave Lawrence and her sister an anxious glance, aware that they'd been quarreling. "Sure," Lawrence said brightly. "Is that thing really going to work?"
"Certainly," Denise sounded offended. "We've practiced the route a dozen times. The river is the easiest way out of Arnoon. The hovercraft will take us straight to Rhapsody Province. One of the articulated trucks from Dixon is already at the rendezvous point. It'll take the dragon all the way down to Memo Bay's airport. We'll be there in 15 hours. After that, it's all up to you."
"Don't worry. My contact has sent a plane to collect us. Where's the cargo pod? We can hardly load the dragon into a Xi'an T as it is."
"The cargo pod is with the truck. An RL-33, industry standard 60-ton capacity. We'll put the dragon inside when we get there."
"Okay. Let's go."
Simon was appalled to discover that there was no supersonic transport on Thal Spring. He wound up commandeering the presidential jet, which could barely reach Mach 9. It was a converted 50-seat medium-range commuter jet that had a flight time of 4 hours to Memu Bay. He spent the time working with his personal AS, dropping hundreds of askbings into Memu Bay's data pool. The leisure company that Michelle had signed up with to go diving among the atolls had no file on any employee called Joseph, nor on Raymond, who was supposed to be his friend. The AS trawl couldn't find any abnormalities in the company's memory blocks. No substituted files, no gaps in the daily boat trip logs for a month either side of Michelle's visit. Even the financial accounts were in order.
"Arrest them," Simon ordered Ebrey Zhang.
"Who, exactly?" Memu Bay's governor asked.
"The company's senior management, their diving gill instructors, boat crews. Bring them all in for questioning. I want them in custody by the time I arrive."
"Yes, sir."
The governor's noticeable reluctance made Simon review the current situation report for Memu Bay.
"For God's sake," he muttered, as the indigo script scrolled down. "And to think he'd warned the SK-2 to keep an eye on the place." Memu Bay had gone into meltdown over the last week. Asset realization was down to 50% of estimated targets. Two-thirds of the settlement's factories had some kind of strike action going on. The entire mayor's office had walked out and refused to work with Ebrey Zhang following the Grabowski rape case. The rest of the civil sector was reduced to emergency services only. Platoon morale was rock bottom, with charges accumulating against 30% of ZB's personnel. TB cases were still being reported. Immunization implementation was slow. Sabotage against utilities was a daily occurrence. Several districts had become no-go zones, and that included for skin platoons. Collateral no longer worked. There were reprisals every time. Zhang was afraid to use any more necklaces for fear of making the situation even worse. The more Simon studied the breakdown and its history, the more interested he became. Essentially, ZB had lost control of the settlement. The resistance group led by Killboy had waged a beautifully orchestrated campaign against the invasion, building to this climax of near anarchy. "Why, though?" Simon asked a dismayed Braddock Rains. "How does this help our alien? Wiping out Zhang's little command is hardly going to cripple Xantiu Braun."
"I'm not sure they could even do that," Braddock commented. "Physically eliminating every skin stationed in Memu Bay would be difficult even for them. They can force the platoons off the streets and back into their barracks, maybe even make them fall back all the way to the airport.
But if you hit those lads too hard, they'll hit you back. Part of the problem is Zhang holding back.
You might be onto something there, Simon said. With the platoons off the streets, the alien is free to do what it wants in Memu Bay without us noticing. But we still don't know what that is.
The presidential jet landed without incident. There was very little activity at the airport. Half of its buildings were operating on reserve power supplies, thanks to the resistance group severing a set of superconductor cables two nights earlier. Skins patrolled the perimeter. A helicopter was waiting for Simon. He climbed in as a big Pan Skyways cargo jet took off, heading for Durrell with a hold full of assets. Skins had to clear the square in front of the town hall so the helicopter could land. The displaced protesters jeered and threw stones over the barricades. Simon's skin escort closed in around him. He never normally noticed them, but today he was grateful for their presence. He didn't often get this close to physical danger. The clamorous hostility of the crowd made him distinctly uncomfortable. Every Zhang had a huge number of valid reasons why Memu Bay was in its current perilous state. He was very eager to tell Simon each and every one of them. "Forget it," Simon said curtly. "I know exactly why this mess has built up. Not that knowing is going to help you much before the Board of Inquiry." Every Zhang did his best not to scowl. "Did you round up the Leisure Company people?" Simon asked. "Yes, and it wasn't easy. My platoons get into difficulty every time they step out of their barracks. I'm not prepared to tolerate this situation. It will interfere with my investigation. Can you enforce a proclamation of martial law?" "Probably," Ebrey Zhang said. "It'll be difficult in some districts." "Declare it. Order a curfew for 6 o'clock that will be in place for 24 hours. Authorize the skins to dart anyone found on the streets after that time. Close down all vehicle traffic and limit domestic data pool access to entertainment and official calls only. Any acts of resistance or aggression against us are to be suppressed by lethal force. One collateral necklace will be activated per incident." "Very well. But we'll probably have trouble getting people back to work afterward. We might not be able to meet our asset quota."
"Irrelevant. I've already written it off. Now I want to see the prisoners."
The interviews followed a pattern. Initial superficial defiance, which swiftly faded when the interviewee realized just how serious Simon was. He began to learn what had happened. Joseph Rachura and Raymond Jang had been taken on at the start of the last season. Popular guys who never lacked for female company. Management couldn't explain why there were no files. With their cooperation, Simon's personal AS swiftly tracked down the substitutions. Implantation of the ghosts was little short of miraculous. They had birth certificates, school grades, parents who had similar digital histories, bank accounts, credit coin bills, medical records, tax records, insurance policies, apartment rent agreements. They were more real to the data pool and the AS than half of the people belonging to Memu Bay's underclass. Verbal interrogation confirmed Joseph and Ray had left the company around the time ZB's starships had arrived. No one could remember the exact date. It had been a confused time. They'd not been seen since. Nobody had managed to contact them. The instructors who were friendly with them believed they were from out of town, one of the hinterland settlements. Definitely not local, though. Someone thought they lived in a suburb close to the Nyum estuary. They certainly had a female housemate. Several instructors had hit on her in the marina bars, possibly called Denise. The AS immediately began generating an image of her from their descriptions. "Find the house," Simon ordered. "I want every estate around that estuary visited by skins. Physically verify the occupants of each house, apartment, and hole in the ground. I want a complete verbal history of occupancy for the last 5 years, which they're to cross-reference with the AS. The curfew had been in place for 2 hours when 15 platoons began the door-to-door search. So far, the proclamation of martial law had proved remarkably successful. Memu Bay's inhabitants had realized from Zhang's announcement that he wasn't bluffing. Most people started heading home by 4 o'clock.
The fact that the roads really did shut down at 6 caught a few motorists out. The traffic regulator AS disabled every vehicle other than bicycles. Drivers hurried home on foot. Several were darted by skins. Diehard protesters outside the town hall and various skin barracks were darted without warning at 1 second past 6. Simon and Braddock received a call about a possible suspect location at 11:15 and immediately took a helicopter out to the Niyum Estuary estate. It was a bungalow rented by a property agency. Nobody answered the door when the skin had rung the bell. When he asked a neighbor, he was told that a girl called Denise lived in it by herself. Her two male housemates had left several weeks ago. None of that corresponded with the information that the AS trawled out from the data pool concerning the bungalow. 5 skins were standing guard in the garden when Simon arrived, along with a small team of ZB technicians. A further 3 skins were inside. Simon and Braddock gave the bungalow a quick inspection. Someone had abandoned their breakfast. A dish of cereal and a mug of coffee were left on the table in the kitchen. 2 slices of toast stood in a stainless steel rack, untouched. Braddock sniffed at the coffee mug and pulled back fast, his nose wrinkling in disgust. Several days old, I'd say. We'll go for an expert opinion. Simon told one of the technicians to analyze the food to see if he could determine how long it had been standing. It would have been early morning here when Joseph was captured at the spaceport, he mused, as the technician took a sample of the semi-solid cereal. Another technician was examining the bedrooms and bathroom for skin and hair samples. The very frightened neighbor said she thought Denise worked at a school. No, she didn't know which one, but it could be a play school. I want every head teacher in the city brought in, Simon instructed Zhang, right now. I've got a DNA match, the technician reported. A skin sample from one of the disused bedrooms belongs to Joseph. Excellent, Simon purred. It was coming together beautifully. Of all the challenges, puzzles, and pursuits he'd been involved in over the years, nothing had given him greater satisfaction than this. Some small part of his mind was childishly excited by the prospect of encountering an alien, even though that encounter would bring enormous upheaval, possibly even war, given the alien's recent actions. That made him pause. Interstellar war was impossible, surely. If commerce was impractical, then invasion and conquest must surely be out of the question. Then why was the alien so hostile? He knew the answer was close, if the facts could just be put together in the right order. Mrs. Pachansky was the 19th head teacher to be brought before Simon. It was 3:30 in the morning, and he'd resorted to far too much strong coffee. The caffeine was slowly abrading his temper and contributing to a subtle depression. It was one thing to be the butt of smart-mouth insults, but he could actually sense the naked thoughts of each teacher, know how much he was genuinely despised and hated. That could wound a man's soul. "Does Denise work for you?" Simon asked, as the old woman stood in front of him. "I don't know any Denise." It was a perfect schoolmistress voice, instantly instilling a sense of complete inferiority in any listener. She was one of the few teachers to arrive fully dressed. Simon imagined even the skins would be made to wait until she had chosen appropriate clothes and put them on in her own time. "Ah," he murmured contentedly. He tented his fingers and rested his chin on the apex. A pane on his desk lit up to show the image that the AS had generated from the descriptions of the lovelorn diving instructors. "Is this her?" "If I don't know her, then I can hardly identify her, can I?" "But you did know her, and it's what you think that is interesting." Mrs. Pachansky's face remained perfectly composed. Alarm shivered through her mind. "Did you know what she was connected with? Which resistance movement?" His D&I was scrolling the woman's file. "If this farce is over, I'll be going home now. I trust you'll take me back with the same alacrity with which I was brought here." "Sit down," Simon barked. Mrs. Pachansky fussed around with the chair, deliberately taking her time.
Her thoughts were settling into a steely determination. "When did you last see her?" Simon asked.
"You know this person's name, yet you're not sure what she looks like. That's very odd."
"Very. Especially if you were to check your school's records, because she's not in any of your files. Nor is she in any file we can trawl out of the data pool."
"That must make it difficult for you to persecute her."
"When did she leave? Please."
"No."
"Very well. You're free to go. I'll have a car take you home." Mrs. Pochansky gave him a suspicious look.
"Why?"
"Because you're obviously a tough old lady who isn't going to tell me anything."
"Why?"
"After the car drops you off, it'll pick up someone who will be more cooperative." The Indigo file scrolled down across his view of Mrs. Pochansky. He picked a name. "Jedzella, perhaps."
"What a pathetically crude attempt at blackmail. You'll do no such thing."
"We killed your son. I expect you think of us as barbarians who answer to no one on this world. You would be correct in that. I'm not even accountable to anyone on Earth. And I am desperate to find this girl, truly desperate. The children will tell me who she is and where she came from. Do you want to put them through that? Because I will ask them if you make me."
"I haven't seen her since the weekend," Mrs. Pochansky said.
"Thank you. Now, tell me all about her." The huge Pan Skyways cargo jet taxied slowly through the miserable gray rain that was saturating Durrell's spaceport. It turned onto the parking apron and braked to a halt. Steam shivered off the nacelles as the spinning fans wound down to a stop. A robot tractor nuzzled up to the front-wheel bogey and engaged its locking clamps. It began to tow the plane into a nearby hangar. The doors slid shut behind it, and it stood all alone in the enclosed space, dripping on the concrete floor. Pan Skyway's hangar staff brought a pair of air stairs up to the cabin hatch, and the two flight crew emerged. They were followed by Lawrence Newton in his full sergeant's uniform. He paused on the top step, conscious of the cameras dotted round the hangar. ZB required any asset cargo flown by a civilian airline to be accompanied by a company representative. The AS would be checking his face and matching it with his file and the assignment orders issued by Ebrey Zhang's office. Colin Schmidt waited for him at the bottom of the air stairs, a small smile playing over his face. "Welcome to Durrell." Lawrence put his arm around his old friend's shoulders. "Good to be here." They walked along the side of the fuselage to the rear of the plane. "I thought you were joking when you called," Colin said. "A whole RL-33 pod. Holy crap. This I have to see for myself." The clamshell doors that made up the aircraft's tail section were hinging apart. Colin ducked under them to stand in the widening gap. The cargo pod filled half of the cavernous fuselage, a long pearl-white composite cylinder resting on a cradle. "I guess you weren't joking," Colin said. He looked around to make sure none of the civilian hangar staff were nearby, then lowered his voice. "Okay, what the hell is in it?" Lawrence opened the flap on his breast pocket and took out a gnarled lump of rock. It glinted dully in the hangar's light cones. Colin took it from him, examining the lump gingerly. "It's argentite," Lawrence said. "That's a silver mineral."
"Silver," Colin said.
He looked from the little chunk in his hand to the cargo pod, then back to Lawrence. "You are joking." "No. What we have here is about 40 tons of argentite with a very high silver content." "Where in God's name did it come from?" "Out in the hinterlands. I thought I saw it last time I was here. Nobody else in the platoon recognized it, so I kept quiet."
"Shit!"
Colin was laughing, hand over his mouth. "You old fraud, Lawrence. You told me we'd need to snuggle a backpack up to orbit." "If I'd said a fully loaded Shianti, you would never have agreed. Now you have an incentive. Can you get this into orbit?"
"Yes."
Colin was still laughing.
"Oh, God, yes. 40 tons of silver. Lawrence, you are goddamn unbelievable."
40 tons of silver mineral. We'll have to refine it when we get back to Earth. Colin nodded, suddenly sober. Of course. I'll have to make sure it's flown down to Cairns. After that, we can get it off base easily enough. But, Lawrence, I don't know how you get this mineral stuff refined. What do we need? One step at a time. Let's focus on getting it up to the Corriboo for now, shall we? Have you got me my pilot? Yes, yes. Gordon Dreyer, he's our man. Needs money and smart enough to keep his mouth shut about it afterward. Fine. What about getting the cargo pod through security? Its contents are on file as fusion reactor parts. It can't go through any sort of scanner. I can handle that. There are hundreds of these identical cargo pods coming in and out of the spaceport. It's just playing the shell game, but on a much bigger scale, that's all. I've got the verification codes. I can enter a full clearance file. The AS will never know the difference. Like going over the fence again, huh? Like going over the fence. Colin was staring at the pod again, his expression hungry. Damn it, Lawrence. I already know the house I'm going to buy with this. I saw it once on the Riviera. It was a white stone mansion with gardens over 150 years old, fit for a board member. Lawrence felt a surprisingly large twinge of guilt as he listened to his friend's daydream. But the choice had been made back when he was dreaming the dragon's dreams. All his old loyalties were over now. Gordon Dreyer arrived 6 hours before his flight was scheduled to take off. Lawrence hadn't met him before, but he knew the type well enough. Late 40s with a highly secure job that sounded glamorous but was actually routine and wasn't going to take him anywhere career-wise. Two marriages behind him, Colin said, and the courts diverted a big slice of his salary to pay for them. He was bitter about the rulings. He partied hard, drank a little too much, gambled above his credit limit. In the flesh, Dreyer's weight was pushing the upper limit permitted by ZB's fitness requirement. His dark hair was meticulously cut and styled to hide its thinness. V-riding follicle treatments were currently beyond his means. He shook Lawrence's hand firmly enough and played it cool when the deal was explained. Only the eagerness with which he accepted betrayed his true character. As with all pilots, Dreyer shadowed the flight preparation. It started with a review of the Xi'an-T's flight engineering file, ensuring its performance was up to the specified levels and that standard maintenance had been carried out. His authorization was added to the flight worthiness log, which would allow the space plane to be moved to the next stage, cargo loading. Gordon Dreyer went to inspect the cargo pod and the pre-flight integration hangar. Colin Schmidt was the lieutenant in charge of the logistics that morning, meeting all the pilots who were readying their craft for the daily flight up to the starships. They walked along the row of sealed cargo pods, discussing any problems or special requirements. At the end, he presented them with the security verification file, detailing the inspection process for each item of cargo. Dreyer added his authorization to the file and thanked Colin for doing his job. The RL-33 pod was loaded into the Xi'an-T, which was then towed out to its fueling bay. Gordon Dreyer went off to the pilot's locker room to get ready while the cryogenic tanks were being chilled down, then filled with liquid hydrogen. Lawrence and Colin rode over to the makeshift medical center in the terminal building. "The hospital's been off limits since the blast," Colin explained. "They're taking care of some senior officers from Fleet Intelligence in there. Security won't allow anyone else near the place." They found an empty room and began sticking medical modules to Lawrence's torso. His arm was then covered by a dermal membrane sheath with more modules stuck over it. "I wish you didn't look so healthy," Colin complained. "You're supposed to be a priority medevac case." "I heard that in old wars, soldiers used to eat the gunpowder from their bullets. It made them look really sick." "You want some energized explosive to chew on?" "No, thanks." He pulled on a medical division coverall. With its short sleeves, everyone could see the membrane and small modules. It should convince the ground crew who saw him embarking. Prime entered his record files in Memu Bay, implanting an attack during an urban patrol which had burned through his skin, leaving him unfit for duty. The fueling bay had a small operations center with a rank of darkened glass windows that looked out over the big delta-shaped Xianti. Stairs in one corner of the center led down to the covered bridge, which had extended out to the space plane cabin's airlock. Gordon Dreyer was already in the center when Lawrence and Colin entered. He was talking to a security officer who handed him the flight's communication key. "Do you need any help with that arm?" Dreyer asked. "No, sir," Lawrence said. "I can manage, thank you." A camera was fixed to the top of the bridge entrance. Lawrence could feel the sweat on his forehead as he walked underneath. At least it added credibility to his supposed injury. Dreyer was impressively calm as they walked along the bridge. The cabin hatch slid shut, and Lawrence let out a sharp breath of relief. Sneaking around like this wasn't his arena. Give me head-to-head combat any day. "Home free, eh?" Dreyer said. "Set yourself down and leave the rest to me." Lawrence chose a seat directly behind the pilot where he could see the console displays. Dreyer was absorbed by the final checklist. 3 minutes later, he agreed with the space plane's AS pilot that they were ready to lift off.